Welcome to the podcast of the Diane Rehm Show Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists joins Diane to discuss the week's top stories from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, Live Search, and Ask.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. At the height of its popularity, Bloom County appeared in more than 1,200 papers around the world. When Berkeley Breath had retired the strip in 1989, he said, quote, "A good comic strip is no more eternal than a ripe melon. The ugly truth is that in most cases, comics age less gracefully than their creators." Now, in a new children's book, he looks at the relationship between children and their mothers. The book is titled Mars Needs Moms, and Berkeley Breath joins me in the studio. It's a great reunion. Berkeley and I talked some 20 years ago when Opus, that cute little fat little penguin, was running all over the place, so it's good to have him here in the studio again. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. It is great to see you.
I'm so happy to be here 20 years later.
Isn't that something?
And Opus is still there 20 years later.
Who would have thought? And he is just as appealing as ever.
I'd like to think so.
He really is.
I think I was right about what I said, that comic strips age less gracefully than their creators. And when people ask me, why aren't I still doing Bloom County with all those characters and the same attitude that it had and the same level of nutty irreverence, I would say that it had its time. It was a perfect thing for the 80s. It was a remnant of the 80s. And I didn't think it would age well as things were changing so fast. And what I mean is that I started cartooning at a time when there was no Jon Stewart, there was no cable, there was no web, there wasn't the vomitous cavalcade of snarky, sarcastic, cynical, topical, satirical comedy. That's all around us now, that we had it all by ourselves. There was Doonesbury, there was the Johnny Carson monologue, and there was Saturday Night Live. And that was it. So it was a perfect opportunity for someone who didn't know enough about the conventions of his own artistic genre to step in and break all the rules, which is
exactly
what people wanted to say.
Interesting, breaking all the rules included being a great fan of Doonesbury and sort of in the beginning lifting some of Doonesbury.
I had not grown up with comic strips. They didn't mean anything particularly to me at the time. So unlike most artists starting out who are calling forth from a long history of artistic influence, in college, I was basically thrown out of the legitimate areas of the newspaper for pulling Jason Blair moments. I couldn't deal with facts. My imagination just would not limit me to the truth, which isn't a good place to be if you're in journalism, which is where I was. So they basically said, you need to be, the only place we know where to put you is at the cartooning desk, and you can lie to your heart's content and cause as much trouble as you want. I didn't know anything about cartoons. I could draw a little bit.
You could.
And the only thing around me I could look at for a reference was Doonesbury. So like every college cartoonist, you basically spent the first couple of your years mimicking Doonesbury, which, of course, kids end up mimicking me after that.
Have you ever met Gary Trudeau?
Oh, dear Gary, I have not actually met him.
You kind of worried about that?
He was a patient man in those years. He understood, understandably, took some exception to some things, but he actually was quite gracious about it, and it would be nice to meet him one day.
Let me ask you about your name. When you and I talked 20 years ago, I can remember addressing you as Burke Breathitt. It has now become Berkeley Breathitt. Tell me why.
Yeah, I can tell you the exact date that it happened. It was September, about the middle of September in 1990, after a trip to England. And I was having something built over there. So I was meeting all the workers in the factory that was working on this thing. And I didn't understand when I was being introduced to them why they had that look on their face that now I understand so well as soon as they heard my name. And it wasn't until I got back to the States and I asked an English friend why might I have gotten this reaction from people when I was being introduced to the working class guys in southern London. And I can't say it on the radio, but the word Burke is an extremely offensive word in English slang that I, if you had a 5-second delay, I might say it and you could do it. But it is something I wouldn't ever say in polite society. And I couldn't deal with my name after that. I'm a complete Anglophile and my roots go back to England. And I couldn't live with it. And sure enough, I made sure that my name was Berkeley after that. And I was born with Berkeley, and I changed it to Burke as a kid. And back it went to Berkeley and never to return.
And Berkeley Breathitt is here in the studio with me. He's got a brand new children's book out. It's titled Mars Needs Moms. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. So, why does Mars need moms?
They have been looking down on our planet for hundreds of years with their telescopes and seeing with envious eyes the very thing that they don't have up there, which is moms. And it looks pretty darn good to them. So they came down and grabbed a couple, but all they could find was Milo's. And he is a little boy who's having some problems with his mom, is having some issues, and sees her only in a one-dimensional way, which is basically a bit of a disciplinarian and tyrant. And so when the Martians grab his mom, he follows them and ends up on the planet and sees exactly what they have in store for their moms, which they plan to steal more of. And in the process, something happens, and he gets in trouble. And as it plays out, we discover, and he discovers, and hopefully the children reading the book discover, the third dimensions of moms and parents that sometimes they're not aware of, which is that nowhere else on the planet will they ever have another person that is willing to love them so much that they would die for them, which, I discovered as a parent. Just a few years ago, this new dynamic of living, having another entity in my little arms that I would take a bullet for.
How old is he?
I have a 5-year-old Milo who is actually stars in the book, and a 7-year-old daughter Sophie.
Now, tell me your impression of why this book has become so controversial.
We didn't spot this, and it segues into kind of the motivation for doing it. Now that I parsed it out, I'm being asked on tour about where the ideas come from. Everyone always wants to know where your ideas come from. And I thought about it long enough, and I realized that I probably did do this for my mother. It's not as simple as a Valentine for my mom, but I have the... Well, let me tell this story just to illustrate it. I was at a signing a few days ago, and I read the story, which is unusual. I normally don't do that because picture books don't really work at signings because you can't hold them up. People aren't 5-year-olds in the audience. But I did finish the book, and a woman walked up to me right away with tears in her eyes, and she pushed the book back to me, and she didn't want it signed. She says, "You can have it. I think it's stupid." And she turned around and left. And everyone else had clearly enjoyed it. I hadn't got that response before. But I had heard that there were some people having problems with the theme of the book. So I stopped her, I pulled her back, and I said, you know, I'm in the business of offending people with the cartoon strip. I know how to parse negative responses and negative reviews. When people say something is stupid, what they usually mean is that they're offended by it. But people never admit to being offended at something. And usually it gets filtered out through the stupid comment. And sure enough, she was crying. Clearly, it had hit some mother issues.
Been
with her.
Moved, absolutely.
Well, what it was that she turned around and said, when I asked her, "Can you explain yourself a bit more?" She said, "I didn't have that mom." Hmm. That mom in the book, which lays down her life for her child, which is a revelation for the kid in the book. And I said, "You know what? I didn't either. That's not my mom. You think I'm putting my idealized mom on my book? I'm not. I have my own mother issues." And things that I will be needing to deal with for a long time, like everybody. Tune into the Oprah Show. You hear them. Everyone has them. And I thought about it and realized that I needed to let it go, because if you look hard enough, you can see with your flawed parents, no matter how flawed they are and no matter how many times they might have failed, in your eyes they might have failed you on that test of sacrifice, you usually can see evidence that you might have overlooked, that they did take they would have, and they probably did take that proverbial bullet for you in various moments that you might have overlooked. In my case, my mother stayed in a bad marriage for 10 years, a miserable marriage for 10 years, only waiting for her kids to grow up old enough to handle it when she finally left my dad. And that's why I did the book, saying that I think, if I'm parsing this out, Mom, you're not the idealized mom in this book, but I know deep down that when the chips were down, you would have taken the bullet. You would have given me your space helmet so that I could breathe, and you did it. And the proverbial space helmet from my mother was staying in a terrible marriage for 10 years.
Berkeley Breathed. His new book is titled Mars Needs Moms. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning creator of Bloom County and Opus. We'll talk more about his book, his comics. The one I read last Sunday certainly had some political overtones
to it. It happens.
We'll be right back. And here's an email from Doug in Fort Worth, Texas, who says, "I've been a fan of Mr. Breathed since the early days of Bloom County. I think he's wonderfully talented, a humorist. If I had not had Bloom County to look forward to every day during college, I'm not sure I would have made it. I'm sure he gets this constantly, but could you ask if he would ever consider doing another syndicated cartoon strip, and also if it's possible to find copies of his first cartoon strip, Academia Waltz?"
I just learned that, of course, like everything else, somebody has stuck all of my college cartoons, which is what he's referring to, Academia Waltz, online, of course, which was a deep shock to me because they should have been buried forever. You know, when you're just starting out and you're cutting your teeth on this stuff, you make a huge amount of mistakes beyond political correctness. There were cartoons that should just never have seen the light of day again. So the question is, would I bring those old strips back and put them in a book? Would be no. They were so terribly drawn and the ideas so unthought out, if I could be really gentle about it, they best stay in the vault, which they will be.
Last Sunday's cartoon strip in the Washington Sunday Post, which is where it only appears once a week. Is that what
It's just once a week
now. Once a week. Took off on Starbucks. Tell me about that strip.
Oh, with Howard Schultz?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's as usual, it's my parsing my own life and putting it through the cartoon filter. I am of a completely divided mind about some place like Starbucks in that I love their product. I don't like seeing it on every corner pushing the other little coffee shops off the corner any more than anybody else does. But I go in and get their damn Frappuccinos. So how big a hypocrite are we? But it explains why it's doing that. I can think of worse CEOs than Howard Schultz, by the way.
What about your political demonstrations of your political dissatisfactions in your comics?
You know what you have to be careful of? What I have to be careful of is not getting too angry. When I look back, and now I've got 25 years of cartoons to look back on, 28 actually, I can pick out the ones that I think didn't work very well. And inevitably, they were the ones that I let my own anger about issues surface too close to them. And inevitably, what gets sacrificed is the humor. And when you lose the humor in this stuff, you lose it all. We are in the business of being funny. If we can also make a point at the same time, great frosting on that cake. You still got to be funny. So it's been interesting. I wouldn't have come back in the last few years if it wasn't for the Bush administration. I could not stand along the sidelines of this game while everyone else got to play. So it helped push me back on at least once a week. But on the other side of that coin is that I could not read a headline and let myself all get bent out of shape about it and go right to that to the drawing table.
What did you have to do?
Take a step back and take a broader view of things. I made it a point, if anyone was bothered doing such a silly thing, you could go back the last 3 years of my strips and see how many times the word Bush appears in the comics. Almost never. Whenever I felt angry about something that the administration might have done, it was kind of part of my job to step back. And it helped by the fact that I have a 3-week lead time. So it was almost too dangerous to go jump on anything particularly that happened, because inevitably the world was changing so fast I would look like a total fool in 3 weeks by the time it appeared. So it forces you to taking broader views on stuff and keeping it more oblique, which is inevitably making it more interesting and make it a bit more timeless.
Give me an example.
Oh. It's going to be hard for me to think of an example since I'm always thinking I nearly forget everything I draw once it leaves my head.
I
immediately thinking of the next strip.
Well.
But if you take any particular bit of bad news about the war, any one of the members of the administration that have been hit by a scandal, which is getting so numerous now, that's a good example. If I chose to do a Wolfowitz cartoon, which is begging to be done. I mean, God knows all the material is right there. It's too dangerous. In 3 weeks, as fast as these scandals are hitting, it'd be old news. He's got at least four more members of his upper echelon that need to be nailed with a scandal, which will happen in the next 4 weeks. So it's too dangerous to hit Wolfowitz when, you know, I'm three scandals old by the time it hits in 3 weeks. So
you just as soon step back.
Step back and take a broader view. See what's going on here. The fact that it's a bit of the frog in the ever-warming pan of water syndrome, I think, that we're in right now in the past 6 years. This stuff is so outrageous, and it keeps happening, that if we could get some perspective on it from a distance, especially with time, I think there would be more outrage that nowhere in the history of of this great nation, have these things happened before? But it's happening so much that we've gotten accustomed to it, like that frog in the warming water. We don't know to jump out and say, wait a minute, it's about to boil. It still seems like it's just getting warm. When, if this, believe me, in 20 years, we're going to be looking back, just shaking our heads, looking like Opus, you know, with the little drops flying out of his head going, ah, we were nuts. So
I want to go back to Mars Needs Moms because it, I think it's a very important book, which I intend to give to my daughter this week, and for her two children, 7 and 5. You left your previous publisher because of their reaction to this book.
Yes, I did. 25 years with Little Brown. Great relationship. We sold millions of books. And it was just, it's exactly what happens with authors when they discover that the property that they wrote isn't completely understood by the people that need to go out and promote it and push it. And sure enough, they even offered more money for it, but they wanted to water down the moment in the book of sacrifice, the picture of mom on the planet of Mars dying because she gave her little boy her space helmet, her little boy who never saw her as anything more than the person that told him to eat his broccoli and was resentful about it. And that was a moment. There's an orthodoxy in children's literature that's very strict. Nowhere is PC live harder and more rigidly than in children's picture books. The fact that I had a mother dying visually in the book, they said, we'd be delighted to do the book if you could just make her look like she's a little nauseous.
Ah.
And I said, that's the whole point of the book. She's not getting nauseous for her boy. She's dying for her boy. And they said, that's too much. And I found an editor who said, no, don't change a thing. I don't know how controversial it'll be, but this is the heart of the book. It's in the same thing with a comic strip. I was always on the edge of what people expected with the comic, and the editors had to understand that going in, that this is what they're getting. Don't get mad at me later if you're surprised by this. This is the business that we're in. And with this book, as with all the stories I write, I have to explore something I hadn't seen before or it's not interesting to me. In 1980, there had never been the kind of humor that I wanted to explore in comic strips on the page before. I wasn't aware of that because I knew so little bit about the business, but it helps explain why Bloom County took off the way it did in 1980.
What did you do with your time off?
I did try moving it to children's literature. I didn't have children yet, which is a great liability in children's literature. We all comforted ourselves, those of us who were doing children's books, who didn't have children, by the knowledge that Theodore Geist, Dr. Seuss, not only didn't have children, he didn't like children. You brought a child into a room with Theodore Geist, and he went the other way. So I said, well, we can do that. I can handle that. And the truth is, he got away with it. I'm not really sure you can. This is a more personal book than I've ever done before. I've done 6 others. I would say this has a more heartfelt theme to it that wouldn't have occurred to me until someone put my baby in my arms. So
you did this book entirely on the computer.
Oh, the secret is out. Yes, but you can't tell. You can't tell me you can't, Diane. Fortunately, my style of painting works very nicely on a computer. What it does is allows you to work much faster. So I can do 3 books a year instead of maybe 1 book a year. And I've got so many stories piled up behind me that they're
fabulous.
So,
all right. We've got lots of callers. We'll open the phones 800-433-8850. Let's go first to West Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I wanted to ask Berkeley, I've been a big fan of your artwork. Sorry to date myself and you, but since I was a little kid, reading Bloom County and then Opus, I was the first in my friends and family to recognize your artwork that was used in the movie Secondhand Lions. When Opus came out, I was interested to see your increasing use of computers, Photoshop. I've been using Photoshop for a long time, and I recognized several of the brushes that you used. I wanted to know, when and why did you actually start using the computer, aside from the speed issue? And I'll take my answer off.
Thanks for calling, Sean.
It is. It's all speed. Right? That's the only
it's
reason.
All speed.
Yeah, it's the only reason you go to a computer. I miss the smell of paint. But it's much healthier that I'm not breathing it anymore. But it's no more complicated than that.
Here's an email from Jennifer in Bethesda, Maryland, who says one of my favorite characters back between 77 and 81 was Cutter John, a wheelchair-bound Vietnam veteran. Is there any chance of reviving Cutter John in light of all the veteran problems in the Iraq War?
You know, it's a bloody good idea.
It's a bloody good idea.
It's become well-trod territory by now, maybe. But I'd have to think about it. Doonesbury has explored the veterans' issues pretty deeply, and inevitably you do look around you and see you're not stepping on anybody else's territory, so, and I wouldn't want to do that with Gary. And he's done it very well. But having a wheelchair character in the strip is still a really interesting thing to explore, and that
may happen. Let's go to Arlington, Texas. Good morning, Steve. You're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Breathitt, I was wondering if you would comment on an idea that I have that your fellow cartoonist, Gary Trudeau, knows more about foreign policy than the entire Bush administration.
That's a comment?
Yeah.
That may be true. I probably would agree with that. Gary, I'm sure, would agree with that. I don't, so that's Gary's territory.
Foreign policy, a very big issue in Doonesbury. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Indianapolis. Hi there, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I really love Berkeley's work. And what I always enjoy is when he has a cartoon that involves animals or some animal issue, and very appreciative of that. He might just comment on that a little bit about his interest in that and how he brings it to his cartoons.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, animal welfare has become a pivotal issue around my house. And there's an example of something that has to be approached fairly judiciously. When I get too emotional, like I said, about issues, it doesn't have to be politics. It can be other things as well. It's after doing this 25 years, I've learned to feel those the old instincts and know when they're there to back up and take a breather. Animal issues are one of them. The best way to approach many of these things are not straight on, but again, obliquely from around behind, slip it in under the door. My feelings about shelter dogs and the overbreeding of designer dogs in this country, I could have done some ugly, bitter, very unfunny strips on that, but instead I back down and thought about how it might be a funny picture book, and came out with a book called Flawed Dogs a couple of years ago, which was basically a gallery of the world's most flawed, most hopefully hilarious-looking dogs in the world's most desperate dog pound, all needing owners. So it was basically a catalog to pick them out from. It highlighted the issue without being overbearing, without being offensive, and it was very funny, and it turned out to be very, very touching to some of the readers, which there's the Holy Grail. And I don't remember getting any mail from people saying that they were offended by it, yet it wouldn't be difficult to do that.
Now, tell me about your lifestyle. Don't you and your family live on a kind of animal farm?
As you approach the house, there's a big sign that says the J&B Dog Ranch, which described it. But like a lot of people, especially in the animal world, where your dogs, your children, once you have children, the dogs go back to becoming dogs again.
How many dogs are there?
Sadly so. They don't appreciate that. They're still looking at us with shocked expressions on their
sure.
face. I mean, what happened?
Yeah.
You knuckleheads.
How many dogs?
Well, attrition has taken its toll. We're down to two now. But there were upwards over four and five at times, which became rather like a wolf pack. So,
what kinds of dogs?
Oh, all the mutts of the world. They came from all around North America, actually. From rescue shelters, we still have a street dog from Puerto Rico who still approaches mealtime as a time of survival, huh. and makes sure that nothing living gets within 40 feet. But otherwise, is a sweetheart. But she came off the mean streets of Puerto Rico and hasn't forgotten.
And protects that food very carefully. What about cats? Cats never a part of your background.
You know, I did flawed dogs, and people suggesting I do one for cats. And my response to cats was really Bill the Cat, which. And if anyone needs to know how I feel about cats, they just need to go there and see. That's all I got for cats. I don't understand them, and they don't understand me.
Well, Bill the Cat is, he's usually in kind of a freaky mode. You know, it's as though his hair is always standing on end.
Yeah, and maybe I'm projecting. That's sort of my response to cats. Maybe I'm just, that's actually me with a cat. So I apologize to the cat lovers out there. I on an abstract level, I love your cats, but please don't put them on my lap. I don't get them. And they don't love me.
Berkley Breathed. He is, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning creator of Bloom County and Opus, his newest book, with a little boy in his mother's arms, is titled Mars Needs Moms. We'll take your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And by UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate November 13th on balancing Americans' right to privacy with national security interests. Live webcasts and PBS broadcast information at millercenter.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As global demand for oil continues to rise, some industry experts warn oil production rates could reach their practical limits as early as 2012. A look at the factors behind the forecast and their geopolitical implications. The Diane Rehm Show, Monday. Here's an email for Berkley Breathed from Stephen, who says, "We have the book, Mars Needs Moms, and love it. My six-year-old lives in the modern world. I think she appreciates the story as it is more than if the mom had been just a little sick."
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice?
I would say vindication is always sweet.
And here's another from Mark in Maryland who says, would you please tell us about your character, Oliver Wendell Jones?
You know, back when you're doing a strip every day, it only stays interesting if you've got a wide enough variety of characters that can explore one's own various interests. And since the strip is basically just a projection of me and my interest in my life, I love science. And so I needed to have a character that was as curious about science and technology as I was. So there's Oliver Wendell Jones. And as a counterpoint to prevailing political wisdom or political correctness, I made him a little African American boy to encourage that this is a kid that's all about school and learning and books and science, which I love to encourage. And now that I have children, I see how important it is. So that's what that was. And as we talk about these characters, I start feeling nostalgic for them, and I'm immediately thinking, gee, maybe I ought to bring him back too.
Yeah.
It's tempting. It's tempting.
Exactly. Here's another from Sharon who says, my husband and I both loved Bloom County back in the day. That fact helped me to decide to marry him. We have all of Berkeley's strips since the military took us all over the country, and we didn't always get them in our local papers. Now our daughters, age 14 and 16, both love reading his books. In fact, the books are now falling apart.
That's fairly typical. Although I'm not sure I want the pressure of being responsible for her marriage. I do hope it's a healthy one.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let's go to Center Sandwich, New Hampshire. Good morning, Janet. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I just wanted to call and say I've been a huge fan for the last 20 years, and my children now, who are 9 and 4, are totally into A Wish for Wings. Every Christmas we have to sit and watch that, and they thoroughly love it. But the other thing that my daughter has made a connection with Opus, because I'm not sure since you have young children, if you've heard of Dog Train by Sandra Boynton.
That sounds familiar.
Well, it's children's music.
Oh, yes, yeah.
A song on it called Penguin's Lament. And when she first heard it, she said, if Opus ever becomes a rock star again, he needs to sing that.
Corrupting a new generation.
Exactly.
Just what I was made for.
And that's all I wanted to let you know, is that you're still wonderful.
Well, so that's nice to hear. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Janet. Let's go to Middleburg Heights, Ohio. Marie, you're on the air.
Good morning. Listening, I have so much more to say than I did when I first called. Mr. Bretha and Diane, thank you. Mr. Bretha, thank you for Bloom County. I have a student, he's an adult now and a teacher, and I was talking to him on the phone the other night, and he was very depressed, and he said to me, I'm going to hang up now and open Milo's Closet, and I want you to realize that that Milo's Closet has become a metaphor now, working, I presume, in more than just Tony's vocabulary. Well, he loved Opus his whole early years and still does, and all his books burned in a fire, and he hasn't been able to replace them. But I also want to thank you for your animal concerns. I did rescue out of Cleveland for many years street dogs from the neighborhood where I taught. They were horribly abused, and as you were talking there and talking about your pack, I'm surrounded by my pack, and I was praying that the mailman didn't come and have them bark before I got to talk to you.
That's good to hear.
Talk about Milo's Closet.
It's the closet of anxieties, and you come up with devices that you can use repeatedly that people can anticipate, and they know where you're going. And, you know, in the first frame, when someone steps out of the closet, you know it's a problem for whoever is in bed and getting the visitor in his room. Reflecting back what she's saying about the impact of this stuff on her friend and other people, it took quite a bit of time and perspective on my part to understand how the material that I was doing as a kid, and I was a kid, I was in my early 20s when this was really cranking in the early 80s, there was not an ounce of conscientiousness applied to any of us at the time. I was the worst professional in the world. It was all flowing right off the top of my head without really any thought as to how it was being received. You know, when you draw this, your cartoon is you're in a dark little closet of a room. You put it and you give it to Federal Express. It goes off in the mail. I didn't read cartoons myself. I never did, and I don't. So I was not a consumer of the product that I was making. And it took many years for me to get enough perspective on it as to really how this worked with people's lives. And I'm not sure that I had the maturity at the time to really grasp it. It's great now, looking back on it, now that I'm a parent and now that I've gone through plenty of issues in my own life, to see how the things that were important to me, the movies, the books, the other aspects of popular culture did get me through bad times. And to hear that now, that people say, I was in a bad spot, I was in college, I wasn't happy, I had been divorced, and I read your book and I felt better afterwards. Now it's terribly touching and meaningful to me. And people always say, before they say it, they say, I know you hear this all the time, and they almost qualify it.
Exactly.
No, we hear all the time, but believe me, tell me.
Exactly.
Because it was a lot of work.
Absolutely.
Looking back.
When these ideas come to you about how this strip is going to look, what it's going to say, what do you do with those ideas? Do you immediately write them down? Do you immediately make some computer notation?
You know, it's different now than it was when I was doing Bloom County. Bloom County was so unplanned. I was so wholly unprofessional about how I did it. I never took a note, never wrote down an idea, nothing until about 40 hours before the deadline, even 20 hours. And this is how I met every deadline that I had from 1980 to 1990. I sat down and watched TV until I could no longer wait any longer. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I would start drawing. And I wouldn't really start thinking seriously about what I was drawing until that moment. And the next weeks where the strips flew out in the next 6 hours. And often I was so late I'd have to get on the airplane and finish them on the plane on the way to Washington, D.C., right here, where I'd get off the plane and give it to a cab driver who didn't speak much English even back then and say, get to the Washington Post. I'd give him $50. I'd turn around, get on the plane, and go back and sleep at the airport because I couldn't drive home. I was so tired. That was the state that these cartoons were drawn in. Unfortunately, you can go back and read some of those and go, you know, these don't make any sense. And it sounds like somebody who hasn't slept for 25 hours. But the others did work probably because I didn't overthink them. And it worked for 1982. I'm not sure it would work now. And certainly I'm not unprofessional enough that I could work on that level again. So I get an idea. I put it on a scrap of paper, and I have a pile next to my desk that piles up over the week. And I go through them, and I take out the ones that really don't work, and I rewrite the ones that I do. And so there's a constant little library of ideas.
Take me back, Berkeley, to that first person who said to you, this is good.
The first response I got from somebody?
Yeah.
You know, it was college. I drew a cartoon. And I had never had anything in the paper before. And I woke up the next morning, and there it was. There were 46,000 students at University of Texas. And instantly, everybody I passed that day said, that was funny. Now, it's a little bit like cocaine for a future addict. And I was hooked at that moment when strangers came up to me and said, I don't know who you are, but this is your name. I thought it was funny. Give me more. And I never turned back. When the first time that I wrote a cartoon that made someone emotional, and unfortunately in my case, it was an emotional in the wrong way. They were angry. They were offended. This is in college, before I knew better. It was an insensitive cartoon. And they came down to the office at the Daily Texan at University of Texas in Austin. And this woman with fire in her eyes walked up and she slapped me right across the face. This is probably the 10th cartoon I'd ever drawn, and stormed out.
Did she say anything?
she may have. It was a couple of curse words, and all I knew was it was about the cartoon I'd just done. And knowing the cartoon, it was deeply insensitive, probably on a racial level, which, being 19, that built-in filter hadn't kicked in yet. And suddenly that was the moment that I realized the power of these damn things, and that along with the great rush goes a rather daunting responsibility. And the bad emotions that I had evoked in this woman and a lot of other people on that campus that day could also be turned around into the inverse of that, into really good emotions, to moving, you know, people. And that's why I went to children's books, because those can work on the same level.
It's very interesting that it takes a while, I think, between that first rush that you got and perhaps whenever you begin to believe in yourself.
True.
Separate the off the top of my head, you know, just the ideas pouring out, to when you really say, I'm doing something useful.
I have to wake up. I can't sleep through this process, that people are affected by it, good and bad, and now particularly good. And that you're absolutely right. It takes time, and that time is always perspective. I didn't have in the beginning. My career went so fast. I was in 1,000 papers by the time I was 21 or 22. I could have really messed up because I didn't have enough time to appreciate how many millions of people were reading this. In those days, which aren't to be repeated now, it's just impossible. But in those days, I had a readership of 50 to 70 million people. Probably the first time that I really became aware of that was only a year into it, when I drew Opus for the first time. Never expecting to draw more than two or three strips. It was a throwaway gag, a penguin sitting on an ottoman watching TV, good for a couple of laughs. I didn't even put words in his mouth. And over the transom came, back in the days when people wrote letters, I had letters in boxes coming from the post office from mostly young kids, young adults.
Who loved Opus.
Who just loved Opus. To me, it was a sketch on a paper. And suddenly I woke up and I said, this is a tiger with a tail that I've gotten a hold of.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to St. Louis, Missouri. Jerry's been waiting for a good long time. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. I have to say, Mr. Breathitt, I've been an admirer of yours for a long time. In fact, I'm holding in my hand a copy of the Academia Waltz, which I guess is the second anthology of some of your work from the University of Texas. And I really consider cartooning to be a kind of a high art, because you're able to say things in three or four panels with just a few lines of dialogue that address some of the issues, not only more comprehensively than long editorial pieces, but with, as you said earlier, a touch of humor. And I would always have to say I found your work, and still do find it, even on the most serious things, uplifting. But I do have kind of an odd question for you. You have something in common with Stephen King in that in your works there are, I've seen at least one, possibly two in yours, oblique references to Ozark Airlines. And as a former employee, I could always pick that out, and I just wondered what the connection was there.
With Ozark Airlines?
Yes.
When you said Stephen King, I was expecting you to say that he has worked in characters that are Bloom County fans in his fiction. He had a character pull off an Opus T-shirt one time in one of his early books, which my first brush with both infamy and fame at the same time. I really don't know what the Ozark reference is to an airline. Do you remember specifically what it was?
Well, it was a Sunday comic, because it was in color, and it took place at I believe Opus was getting horrifically abused by some of the security people.
And it said Ozark on the
side. Pardon?
It said Ozark on the airplane.
No, on the side of just a sign on the wall or whatever.
Yeah, right. Now I realize that this is the Iowa City, Iowa days when I was drawing Bloom County the first 4 years. And that was a local airline. So it was always a kick to work in local references, because the Iowa people, who never get referenced anywhere, got such a charge out of it.
Thanks for calling, Jerry. There's a question. Is a movie coming out called Opus, The Last Christmas?
The better question is there an Opus movie going to come out? And the answer is no. And now I can say it's all for the better. The Weinstein brothers at Miramax tried for 5 years to develop an Opus movie in their first animated film. And it was, let me just say, it probably wasn't destined to be as it probably shouldn't. And the problem with developing these kind of movies and films is that inevitably they discover that the property, as idiosyncratic as a comic strip, doesn't translate well unless you have the confidence of bringing the creator in and factoring him into the creation of the movie. They never do that.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, they just don't trust us. So without that control, there probably shouldn't be an Opus movie.
Here is a final email from Mandy, who says, my mom has been gone for almost 8 years now. When I wonder how to put my mouth on why my imperfect mom was a good one, I now know what to say. She would have died for me. Wow. What a thing
well,
to realize.
There, she got the point of the book.
She got the point of the book, and the book is titled Mars Needs Moms by Berkeley Breathitt. Thank you so much for joining us.
So happy to be here, Diane.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Good luck, and thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Andersman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.